The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Hello everyone, Loose Cannons here, recording our podcast again. We just keep doing this.
Just over and over again. We're like Sisyphus.
Yeah. Just
pushing that rock up a hill.
We're going to be discussing a movie from 1960 called The Warped Ones, directed by a dude whose name I can't pronounce. So you can look it up on your smartphones and your tablets and your
Joe. Patrick will probably write his name under the YouTube video, so you can also just read it there probably.
I'll
put it there.
I apologize. I can say a peach pong we're sithical, but I can't say. I can sort of say it. I can't say this. Someone pointed this out last time. I think it was Basil that we reference each other, but that we don't specify whose voice is whose. So we're gonna in this podcast make it clear whose voice is whose. This is Ruben talking, and if Patrick can say a little something, then Ilya, then Basil, including their name, that would be great.
Hi, this is Patrick. I'm the really nasally sounding guy because I have a gigantic nose that needs to pass a lot of air out of it really fast, so you'll often hear me sniffling and coughing because I'm apparently constantly sick when we do these podcasts. So.
Right. Hey, everyone. This is Ilya. I'm the one with the really crappy microphone and the vague Russian accent, which really is more like a bad American accent than anything else. Right, that's me.
And I'm Basil. I don't know if my voice is more or less nasally than Patrick's, but I also have a big nose, so we could have a war of noses.
War of the noses.
Okay. So that's everybody. Hopefully that was enough for you to recognize the voices and you can tell us apart from now on, in case anybody besides people who know who we are listen to these podcasts.
In case anyone cares.
So, as usual, we're going to start off by sort of saying like whether or not you liked or disliked it, because I sort of host everything. I never say my opinion first, so I'm going to switch it up today. I'm going to go first, and then you guys can go after me, which is to say I'm kind of excited or interested to discuss this podcast because I did not like this movie, and I know that at least one other person did. And it feels like normal we have kind of close to a consensus opinion. So it'll be interesting to see what we talk about, but I guess in my head, this movie is about sort of like rebellious youth and people being kind of crazy, and I guess I'm comparing it to, you know, sort of Graveyard of Honor and Rebel Without a Cause in my head, and how much I prefer those two movies in terms of sort of like wild action, I guess. But okay, who wants to go next?
Do you want the opinion that you know already to go next?
Let's do it.
Sure.
I absolutely love this movie. I thought it was amazing. The Japanese New Wave is really knocking it out of the park for me right now. That's two Japanese New Wave films that I've seen, and both of them are on my favorite films of all time list now. This one, I really love the energy of this movie. It's shot amazingly. It's not just like, it felt like it combined a lot of different styles of shooting too. Like some of it was handheld, some of it was, you know, kind of classically shot where you had like nice moving shots, and Some of it was static stuff, and it felt like a nice mishmash of different styles. And I also just I loved that the direction that the lead actor seemed to have gotten from the director was act like a complete lunatic, because he does that in every single scene. He's just like a complete mad dog throughout the entire film. And I'm glad that you brought up Graveyard of Honor, because that's what I compared it to. I was like, yeah, he's like that. He's just a crazy person all the time, and he's just doing crazy actions with his body all the time. Like at one point he goes into an art gallery and he's just like touching all of the art and just like messing with people and like telling them that the jazz they're listening to isn't real jazz. And he's just, you know, like this this whirlwind of chaos that messes with everything around him. And I love it. I'm interested to hear what Basil and Ilya have to say about it.
I'll jump in next, because actually his acting was something I was going to comment on. I watched this with my girlfriend, and she pointed out that the main character is sort of acting like an ape. Like, the way he, like, makes this weird mouth movement all the time. He's just, like a simian, like, kind of, like, unchecked id, where he just does everything that he thinks of, and he's just like, I'll just do this, and, like, the whole time, the whole movie, like, whenever he's not talking, he's constantly, like, moving his mouth in this very, like, I feel intentional, like, ape-like way, and I think that that's really interesting. And I guess I would fall somewhere in between in that I like this movie, but it's not one of my favorites, but I liked it. I thought of it as being, like, Breathless, but less boring.
I actually really agree with that statement, but actually I'm not sure that would be enough for me to like it, because there were enough moments in that movie that I mean, it basically kept stumping me over and over again, and I wasn't always sure that I was glad that it was. A lot of the times, like, I felt like what was going on, I had not really seen anything like it before, and I haven't seen Graveyard of Honor. Actually, I'm not really up on Japanese cinema in general that much, so I had nothing really like anything like local to compare it to. I only really had like Breathless and a couple, like, I don't know, whatever, like youth going crazy movies, whatever, in my head, which I don't even remember any from right now. But anyway, I thought that, like,
have you seen Rebel Without a Cause?
No, I've only seen, like, the guy.
You're tearing me apart.
I've seen in The Sopranos where one of the guys reenacts a scene from Rebel Without a Cause, I think. So that's like that's my connection to that movie. But I thought, like, there was some serious issues in this movie where I thought, okay, they're really willing to go, like, really, really far compared to Breathless. Like, they really explore, like, the morality and the, like, how fucking depraved this guy is. And they just, like, go from there and make it just really uncomfortable. But I guess I just wasn't sure whether or not, like, it really led to anything. It was uncomfortable and it was really jarring, but I'm not sure it really, like, in the end added up to anything. So I'm not sure.
Well,
go ahead.
Like, so there's a scene towards the end of the movie when he's, like, broken into the apartment studio of the woman that he's raped, and her boyfriend, potential fiance. And they're like, let's just turn on the gas and, you know, make it look like he accidentally killed himself. And I was like, oh, if this is the point of the movie, to get the viewer to the point where you would also murder this guy, I'm like, this has been a tremendous success, because I really want to murder this guy. Like, I'm so done with him.
Right.
End of the movie.
I think it's like, I didn't dislike him at all, but I honestly didn't care that they were gonna kill him. I was like, yeah, that seems like a a logical,
a reasonable solution.
I was gonna say, like, it seems like a logical endpoint for this character, because it seems like, okay, yeah, he's gonna be undone by his own actions. Like, I kept expecting it to be more conventional, like that, where it's like, okay, yeah, the awful shit that he's done is gonna come back, you know, on him, because, you know, you can't just act that way in society, like a complete lunatic, and, you know, expect that, you know, nobody's gonna have something to say about that.
Like,
but
like
the way this movie did end,
rape someone, like, and then steal their handbag,
because,
and then basically be a douchebag to them,
well,
the whole movie,
yeah,
and
let,
then,
let's
like,
not
still get away with it.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, he's definitely, yeah, a terrible person, but for some reason, like, he wasn't terrible in a way that made me dislike the character. I wasn't like, I don't want to watch any more of this guy. I was, like, kind of fascinated with how crazy and depraved he was as a character. And I was like, he has a lot of interesting things going on. And so I was kind of, like, wrapped up in the depravity of him. And the
what
fact
are some
that,
of the interesting things he has going on?
Well, for the thing that comes to mind immediately is, like, his obsession with jazz, but not necessarily, like, I don't like it when people are just like, I love jazz or whatever. Like, he has this weird tick about it. It's almost like he can't control himself, because at one point he's in the restaurant and there's, like, jazz playing, and the woman goes over and, like, takes the record off, and he just, like, goes crazy and breaks a bottle and is gonna stab her because she took the jazz record off the record player. And the other guy has to come in and he's like, no, just calm down. He's like, he, like, shakes him out of it. He's like, you know, it's like he's entranced by jazz or something like that. And there's one point where he's just kind of talking to himself, like, somebody says something about black people, and he's like, black people are the best, they invented jazz. And he's like, and then white people stole it, and he's like, and then we, like, screwed it up. He just goes, we're the worst. It's just, like, real, like, cultural insecurity going on, too.
The part you're remembering is that his friend, who is a prostitute, says that she doesn't want to sleep with black people.
And then he's like...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
She doesn't say it in as nice a way as I do.
No,
yes,
she
doesn't. It's certainly, yeah.
She's not as nice about it as
but,
you were just now, right?
I will also say that this film does actually have a black character in it, and I can't remember if I've ever seen a black person in a Japanese movie.
He's kind of magical, though.
He doesn't really, like do anything magical. He just sort of runs.
That was
the,
sort of my first response to, like, him, like, actually doing anything, was I was like, oh, cool, you don't have to be in America to be racist.
Well, I mean, like, I didn't see anything, like, overtly racist about...
Well, he's the one who saves him from putting the bottle in that person's face.
Well,
and he's like, there's no reason... There's no reason for him to do that.
That's not necessarily magical, though. Like, anybody could step in and do that. Like, it's not. That's
magical,
not like
magical. Doesn't mean that they cast spells.
Their
only purpose is to serve the protagonist. That they don't have any sort of, you know, agency of their own.
But
that
all
they
do is,
and he's
like, "Hey, take my car. Take my car. Here you go." It's like, you know, just. I'll run with you.
But he goes with him too. He's like, you know what? Let's just go to the beach. Let's go to the beach. And then they have a whole scene where they're just, like, at the beach together.
Yeah,
like,
that scene was weird.
I did like the part where they were at the beach.
I was like, this is a strange scene to follow that up with. It just kept this movie, like, kept confounding me. I was like, I did not expect any of this. This is weird and crazy.
I remember one scene with the guy.
That's what I liked about it.
When he's watching his friend have a fight, right? When he's watching his friend fight, like, gang fight with his other gang, and then he's like, fights are only for people who can't appreciate jazz or whatever. And then he walks away. It's like. Like, that quote was pretty funny. Like, I remember that quote. That was really, really funny. That was one of the moments where I'm like, yeah, this guy is... Okay, that was kind of cool, but it's just... Like, I'm really not sure that... Like, actually, to come back to, like, what you were saying earlier about, like, different camera styles and so on. Like, I was... At some point, it kind of... And this sounds really bad. I know it really sounds bad. I'm probably really wrong about this. But it kind of reminded me of, like... Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, It kind of feel like like a lot of this movie was like people screaming and yelling and just everything being over dramatic and crazy, and then they have these weird cameras shooting from one angle to the next, and it's like, oh, and they're going up now, and like he like for some weird reason I had to think of like Magnolia or something, you know, where I know that this is like way off probably and totally like I can't put like B.T. Anderson next to Japanese New Wave, but it kind of did remind me of it, and like, I don't know, that's usually not a good sign when it reminds me of B.T. Anderson.
I've seen a few Paul Thomas Anderson movies. I haven't seen Magnolia, but I don't know. I was never like distracted in that way by what the camera was doing. Like, I was aware of it from time to time, and I was like, oh, I really like what they're doing. And it was always like, oh, I like what they're doing with the camera, and I like the way that this looks, as opposed to being like, why did they do that? Like, that really messed with the scene for me. Like, it never distracted me from what was going on.
And personally, like, you know, I put, even at his most wild, Paul Thomas Anderson, like, closer to the Kubrickian standard of, like, very controlled, like, of his image. Like, it's a controlled wildness, if that makes any sense. Like, he knows exactly how he wants everything to look, and, like, even if it draws from, like, a lot of different styles and stuff like that, then...
And you didn't have this impression here.
No, not so much.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that it seems very... I mean, certain parts of it feel kind of like they just threw it together. There's, like, the driving shots, the camera seems all over the place. Yeah. And it's fun. I think that part of the reason why I like that aspect of it is that having watched a bunch of Japanese movies from around this era and also earlier ones, like, it seems like the director was really trying something that hadn't been attempted that much in Japanese cinema up to that point, which is like, I don't know, you know, that Mizoguchi's movies have a very controlled, like, fluid motion, and all the movies that I've seen around this era, almost all of them have, like, pretty standard shot dimensions and framing. Crazed Fruit has some really weird close-ups and a few other pretty interesting things, but this was the first movie that I think, like, really emphasized montage over mise-en-scène, to use, like, the two kind of stylistic big whatever phrases of film school theory. So it was kind of exciting to see something that looks and feels so much different than almost all the other Japanese movies that I've watched around this era.
I'm going to posit a theory for you guys. So there's a bunch of shots in this movie where Akira and his friend look up at the sun, and like it blows out, and they look like they're like really energized by the sun. Maybe they're kind of like Kryptonians, and the power of Earth's sun makes them crazy and criminals.
Actually, this is not very... even though you're joking, this Superman is actually really close to something that I wrote down.
I'm not joking.
Okay.
The only part of it that's a joke is aliens.
Okay.
That's the only part that's a joke.
Well, I think you're not far off, because the very first shot of the sun... the way it blows out looks really similar to an atomic bomb explosion. So I thought that it was intended as like a metaphor that like this child youth that's like completely uncontrollable is the result of like post-war disaster. So,
and the sun itself is an important symbol in Japan.
Right.
I mean, that's the flag. It's their flag.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think even the title has some relation with
the
word
heat. Explosion,
right?
Of the sun.
Heat, I think, is in the title.
Warped.
Originally. Well, I think Warp Ones is actually is like a later translation.
Just
and originally when it's something like heat or whatever, like beware the heat or something like that. I don't know. So that would fit in with that theory really well. Obviously, I think for me the most interesting part of the movie was the indictment of the of that couple of that are about to, like, or trying to get married or whatever, and how, weirdly enough, even though Akira and his friends are, like, huge douchebags to them and do terrible things to them and constantly, like, are horrible to them, they actually also manage to see through a lot of what's really wrong with them as a couple or with them as people. And obviously, in some way, like, it's probably like a commentary meant to be taken as a commentary on how Japanese society is, like, pretending to go on in some way as if, like, nothing happened or whatever, and, like, they're never acknowledging the effect that, like, something terrible has had on them. And so, in a way, Akira and so on are there to, like rattle them in some way. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. It's like they're saying, like, you're, you know, no better than us, and you can't look down on us. And that there's a big plot point where the woman who Akira rapes wants his friend. I think her name is Yoko. Yeah. Is it? Yuki, that's right. Yuki, she wants Yuki to seduce her boyfriend so that they're on, like, equal footing again.
That's not right. Her first suggestion.
Oh, well, yeah.
Her first suggestion is for Akira to also rape him.
I forgot about that, yeah. But then the plan that actually goes through is Yuki seduces him. And so they're kind of on equal footing, and, like, that's what she wants it for. But it's sort of like this, like, really fucked up morality of, like, okay, I've had, you know, like, my impurities and you've got your impurities, and they're just like, that's, like, even more fucked up than, like, we're, like, wild and crazy people, and, like, we know that that's fucked up. And so it's almost the thing where it's like, you know, how can you judge us when you have these ideas of the world where, you know, somebody is impure when they've had something this horrible done to them, you know, where the gender balance is so off that even though it was something that was forced on this woman and it was something that was horrible that was done to her, he still views her as, like, less and impure for it. Rather than, you know, like, acknowledging that it happened and, like, comforting her, he just ignores that it happened and just has, like, this, you know, stigma towards her because of what happened. And so I liked that the film seemed to be saying, like, you know, they were kind of, like, judging right back at them.
She kept saying that she was hoping that he would confront her even, like, negatively, if he would even, like, acknowledge it in some way. He just didn't even acknowledge it that happened, and that was what drove her crazy. And it's like, okay, and I guess, like, there is, like, commentary in there, like, it screams commentary. I just, like, obviously I don't know how to read it. I wouldn't really, I'm not as really read up on Japanese history.
I haven't read anything about this movie, but I would be really interested to see.
Nobody's written anything about this movie. Yeah, nobody.
What?
There is no writings on these movies.
No critical.
No one. No. Not even in Japanese. Like, the movie came out to absolute silence.
Okay. I'm not. You're making a joke, and I don't really know. Like.
I looked up Roger Ebert and Jonathan Rosenbaum, and they didn't have anything. Oh,
okay,
about it.
So two people didn't have anything to say about it.
Yeah, but the two maybe most important American film critics, not in terms of, like, I'm sure that Donald Ritchie has something to write about it because he just writes about Japanese cinema.
Yeah, I didn't find a lot of reviews either.
So that's what I was saying.
Maybe the two most important American film critics.
It doesn't have to be Rosenbaum or Ebert.
Yeah.
I
imagine that a lot of Japanese people wrote about it.
Right.
In Japanese.
There's probably even I don't have the DVD. I watched it on Hulu Plus, but there's probably, you know, materials on the Criterion DVD.
Pretty likely,
Criterion film. So I would actually be really interested.
I assume
to get
for
that
all
one.
Of those films that they just got Donald Ritchie, they like paid him for 2 days of work, and they just recorded him for like 14 hours of talking about Japanese cinema. Just
broke it up.
All right, today we're going to be talking about Oshima. Here are the 6 Oshima films in which we're releasing on Criterion. Donald Ritchie, just talk for hours.
Go, Donald Ritchie, go.
He doesn't mention this movie at all when he talks about the new wave in his like 100 years of Japanese cinema thing, though. But that's because it's only like 10 pages in a 100 something page book. So, and most of it's devoted to Oshima, as most like surveys of the new wave are. Anyway. I think we all interrupted Patrick in that he was going to say something about Critical.
Oh, I was just saying I would be interested to read more about it because I haven't. As opposed to, I usually try and read some sort of outside source before I go into these podcasts, but I didn't for this one for whatever reason. I think at one point I wasn't even sure that we were going to do this one because we... We're supposed to do it, I think, back to back with One False Move, but then it got moved, and there's a lot of confusion. So,
I have lots of theories.
I was just saying, I would be interested to read more about it.
I'm gonna write some stuff about it.
Well, I don't have any literature, but part of the reason that we're doing this podcast is because Basil is doing research and writing about this topic.
Basil?
If he wants to. contribute any sort of historical
really
context, or
I would actually be, I'd actually be really interested to read what Basil, has to say
about
it.
I'll send you my paper when it's done. Although it won't be that focused on this movie, just because.
It's more about New Wave in general.
Yeah, and just like comparing Shochiku filmmakers to the Mikatsu and other people, because. Like, when the New Wave first started, it was, like, coined as, like, the Shochiku New Wave, which was, like, all directors working under this studio because they were, like, worried about TV and losing money. So they decided to try something which was, like, risky, which was, like, promote a bunch of people who were pretty young assistant directors who normally would have to be assistant directors for multiple years further than they had been before being given their own chance to direct, like promote them early and then give them kind of autonomy to write and direct their own movies. So Oshima was one of them. He was the first one. And then Masahiro Shinoda, Yoshida, and some other ones whose movies I have not been able to find, so I won't be able to include them in my research. But those are the three main guys. And they all released multiple movies in 1960, so that's like the big year. And that's why I picked this movie, which is from a rival studio, Nikatsu, and Pigs and Battleships. And anyway, so to see whether or not there are differences. And this movie is way different than any of the ones that I've watched so far. So there is that.
How so?
Well, stylistically, it looks completely different. Like the references, I mean, when I talked about Breathless earlier, I feel like the jump cutting and just like how wild the editing is in this movie and how frenetic and constant is completely different than even any of the other New Wave people. They don't seem as excited about bombarding the audience with images. Oshima, in fact, uses cuts very, very sparingly and seems more related to Truffaut if you're going to try and draw analogs between two movements that are only connected because people decided to call them New Wave.
Yes.
So like, oh, here's other exciting things happening in Japan. That's awesome.
I love how like every country has a New Wave movement except for America, and America just called their New Wave movement America Independent Filmmakers or Independent, like.
I've heard it referred to as the New Hollywood.
I've never heard that.
I've
really
heard
like
people.
John Cassavetes and like New Hollywood.
Not Cassavetes, more like Scorsese and Coppola, and those guys were considered like new Hollywood.
Right.
Because the way that they made films was way different from like the studio system.
Which really sounds weird now to think of Spielberg or Lucas and Coppola as anything but like elephants.
It is really, yeah.
That, like, these overblown personalities. Like someone thought like they were at some point they were like brash and all, like, you know, like breaking all the rules.
Yeah,
dumb kids.
Yeah.
It's just really hard to imagine that.
Yep, before what they did became all the rules.
But yeah, I think there was a more independent like thing like Cassavetes in the '60s before the new Hollywood, like.
American
Independent Pictures and blah blah blah. Roger Corman.
Roger Corman. Yeah, Roger Corman was a big part of that too.
Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
But America, we're not good enough for a new wave.
I think it's funny that we sort of call our movement something else. That like literally we're like everybody else is going through the same social tumult post World War II. As like the kids who were like little kids, like start to become, you know, late teens, like early 20s, like almost all of them were going through like a similar sort of thing, and so everybody is new wave, new wave, new wave. Oh, but we're not. We're special. I don't know.
It's true. Even though we were just as directly influenced by, but yeah, it's interesting. This is one of the. This is the only movie that seems very directly influenced by the French New Wave compared to the other ones that I've seen so far. Most of them seem to be reacting politically and stylistically to their own Japanese cinema and not so much drawing from the international what have you. What was I going to say? I think it's really interesting how often they mention modern art and how it's dumb, but also the movie seems like invested in an idea of modernism. The stylistic things in the movie, like there's a shot where they go through a tunnel and the shot starts with like the roof of the tunnel and it looks like this weird abstracted just like moving thing that you can't tell exactly what it is until the shot changes, and it reminded me a lot of like Italian futurist paintings where they were like super obsessed with the idea of like speed and violence and like death is coming at you so soon, so like why not just like live life as crazily as possible, which seems to be like the motto of this entire movie. But then like there's a part where he goes to a gallery and is like, modern art's dumb, like I could turn this painting upside down and you can't tell the difference.
I really didn't like that. I was like, I don't know. I felt like that's such a, like, I don't know, high school, college 101 realization.
Yeah.
It's like, look, it basically looks the same when I turn it upside down. And I was like, you're an idiot.
Well,
I hope the director doesn't really believe this.
And also,
I was going to say, like, he's being very, like incredibly rude in that scene though, like that's what I feel like you're supposed to get out of this, it's not even really rude,
it's like it's the most boring version of rudeness that exists. It's like, oh, I've toppled over your whole society by turning this painting upside down. Like,
I didn't think I didn't think that was his motive in doing it. I thought he was just a crazy person.
And like that kind of is like, you know, gets to, I think, most of why I didn't like the movie, and maybe why Patrick did, is that I didn't find him to be particularly crazy. I found him to be mostly kind of boring. And when I wanted him to die at the end, it was because I thought he was kind of boring. That, like, his craziness feels really deliberate and not particularly new to me. Like, the whole, like, obsession with food that runs throughout the whole film sort of seems like the oldest way of showing that someone is like excessive or like gluttonous. The fact that he's like always like eating things like constantly on screen and like in really exaggerated ways, and like he won't stop eating, and I'm like,
you're so sweaty.
Eating's good. Like, I don't know. Like like almost every place in the world except for like a few countries, like eating a bunch of stuff is like good. It's not gluttonous, it's like survival. It's a really a very small amount of humanity that would see, you know, eating a lot of food as like wrong, I guess. And like there's a lot of stuff like that where it's like him being sort of like having an exaggeration of human desires. It's like him being crazy, but to me it just feels really forced. Like, you know, when he starts like laughing or like screaming for something that he wants, like I'm just like, this doesn't feel like, I don't know, wild. It just feels like this would be surprising if this happened. But then it's not really. Patrick,
I was gonna say I didn't so much feel like the fact that he was eating was what made him wild. It was the way that he went about it. Like, when he was consuming things, it was just like, I'm going to go steal all the milk that's been put out, you know? Like, I'm just going to take people's milk bottles and just drink them, like, you know, just straight up drink them. Or I'm going to go steal this chicken from this person's coop who's not home and just cook it right here in the middle of their house and just, like, throw feathers everywhere. I was like, that is something a crazy person does. Like, not necessarily that they're eating all the time.
It just makes it messy.
But that's the thing. Like, you know, that's like, you know, inner turmoil right there. It's just like, I just don't give a shit. I'm just throw feathers all over this person's house. Like, this person who I'm only acquainted with because I raped them. Like, that's the mind of a crazy person right there, basically.
Yeah.
It's just, like, assuming that sort of familiarity with the place.
Right. Now, he also, like, he's pretty much broke the entire movie, and he has very little trouble getting anything he likes, basically, anytime he wants to. Like, he basically, I'll get that milk bottle, no problem. I'll steal that lady.
That car, that motorcycle, yeah.
Everyone always presents
and,
like the
nobody,
mildest
like, nobody protests,
of like,
exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Shaming about it. It's like, no, I can't even drink the milk myself. And then he's like drinking the bottles, and the guy doesn't try to stop him. You know, he's not like, he's like, I'm going to go tell the police. He's just like, no, don't.
I think that is deliberate though. Like
it's deliberate too. I don't like it.
It's weird. Like in a way, it's like you're expecting him to get like to that there will ever be consequences for anything he does, and there never are. Basically, all the way until the end.
The
moment where he flips out because she switches off, like, the music is okay, like, he can't confront his own conscience, because it's like, oh, now I have to deal with this, I can't just, like, you know, I can't just, like, wash it all away with music and, like, food and having sex with random people, or at least coming on to as many people as I possibly can. You know, like, oh, now I have to think about my behavior, and I can't handle it, and so I just want to stab you. You know, like, that's as close as he comes to being, like, to doing something that he doesn't want to do, right? Everything else in the whole movie, in the whole damn movie, he just does whatever the hell he wants, and everyone lets him, right? There's only, like, Yuki doesn't let him, like, have sex with her always, or actually ever, but it, like, okay, like, that's the one thing he doesn't get. But pretty much every other thing he fucking gets all the time, and it's really like, it drove me up the wall to watch it the whole time and just like be like, oh, okay, I guess there will never be any consequences for anything he does. So it's like,
see, like, that's the thing that sort of makes me think of him as like not wild. It's like, who wouldn't act like this in this world? Like, who wouldn't, like, if, like, who wouldn't just eat a chicken in someone's home if, like, the consequences for it is that you fall asleep and leave? Like,
I mean, someone did like, try to murder him. Right. He didn't know about it, but someone did try to murder him.
But I think that's sort of the point.
I mean,
right? Like,
and again, sort of like what makes it like less wild is like what Ilya says is that he's always just sort of following through on like his desires. Like, there's no point in the movie where I'm like, oh, this was really unexpected from him. It's like he's always like eating or horny, or he's like, this art isn't the type of art that I like, so I'll show them. You know, he never does anything where I'm like, you know, he feels conflicted or at all. He's just sort of like, he's like a monkey, you know, like Basil says. He's just like a monkey with no sense of socialization.
I found that to be hilarious, though. For some reason, like, the way he did it, like the way he went about it in this movie, was so funny.
You
to
were
me.
About to,
like I, every time he was doing something, I was just watching him, and I was just like, "What is he doing? He's crazy!" Like that was my reaction to him. Like anytime, like he's in the art gallery, where he's just like touching the art, I was just like, "What is he doing? This
you
guy."
You said that was the point. Basil, that like no consequence.
Well, I mean, I think that the idea is that based on like the fact that it doesn't work when they try to kill him. Because at first I was like, oh, I get it. Like the middle class, like bourgeoisie people, they have to like eliminate this weird intrusive presence to like regain some sense of stability, and so they're gonna kill him. And I was like, okay, that makes sense as an ending. But then it doesn't work. And then the ending that the actual movie has is that like, let's just swap people because we impregnated each other and now like this is the society we've made. Like it's crazy. Like that's like a weird ending, but it makes sense for the rest of the movie, which is that like everyone now in this post-war Japan is just like depraved. They're all him, and he's like just like living in the world that he sees, and now he's like everyone else, like this is where we live now. We just swap people and none of it matters. And, like, it seems sad and weird, but that's, like, it, that felt like that was the point, that, like, yeah, I agree with Ruben that he's not doing anything that crazy. He's just, like, living in the world that he sees, and that the director's just like, this is how things are now. Like, we don't have any...
He's more hedonistic than crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that that's interesting. Like, I think that that's like a weird sense of like defeatism towards reformation and like rebuilding that is similar to something in Rebel Without a Cause, but isn't as effective. I agree with Ruben that it's not as strongly put in that as it is in that movie, but it's like based on what I've seen in other movies, there's definitely a sense that like rebuilding is pointless and everything is the worst. That seems to be the general consensus of Japanese filmmakers during this era.
I was gonna say that does the same thing does show up in Pale Flower, where it's sort of like, you know, the protagonist is just kind of like, what the fuck ever at the end, like this shit.
And but, also, I was going to say that we haven't mentioned that I think explains a little bit of what the movie's getting at, is that at the very beginning of the movie, he's released from prison, or like a juvenile prison facility. So I always took like all his like complete indulgence of everything that he's doing as like a result of like his imprisonment. He's like trapped for so long and then released, and like all this energy has built up, and he just does whatever he wants all the time as a way of trying to release it.
The first scene is them trying to steal from that American, and that's why they go to prison. That fits everything.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's why.
The getting out of the prison is the second scene.
Yeah, that's why they go after that woman, the woman that Akira rapes, is because she's the girlfriend of the guy who like fingered them, who was like, "Hey, they're stealing." You know, like I've
and that's the last consequences in the entire movie.
Exactly.
Well, sort of. His friend does have some consequences.
Yeah, he dies, right? But it's weird.
This movie, despite the main character like sort of committing all the crimes he wants to, his friend who is in organized crime ends pretty badly. He gets, I guess, shot or stabbed or something. While he's like killing the boss of another rival gang, and just sort of dies toward the end of the movie, which I felt really bad about that. I was kind of I liked that there was sort of a happy couple of this, you know, this.
What?
I'm talking about his friend and, you know.
I know what you're talking about.
Right.
My laughter and what still applies.
That's what I'm saying. Like before that happened, they were gonna like, they had kind of a happily ever after thing happening with them, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. They're like, what is that face you're making? I don't. What is that? Like, how?
What is the face that represents laughing and then what?
Right.
He's like,
I don't understand what.
And she sleeps with Americans for money, for him, for them.
They don't know whose baby it is. They think that it's what they call Mr. Innocent. Like,
he's joining a gang.
He's going to join a gang to provide for her.
He's already in the gang. He's already in the gang.
Because she can't keep hooking because
she's pregnant.
That does sound...
And it doesn't... Like, she doesn't like him before the moment when he's like, I'll take care of you. She's like, don't look at me while I'm changing.
She like, she,
she's
she
like, you can't have sex with me.
Him, but
I think she likes him. I don't...
It's still.
I think
a really
she likes him before that.
Couple, definitely. I mean, I guess it makes sense in their world.
It's weird, but I mean, that was the thing though. Is the like she was going to be able to stop living like that, and he was going to provide for her, and like there was going to.
That is kind of the fun. That is kind of the weird thing though. Like they actually do want
honestly
like a family, which is so weird because the way that they fucking approach everything is so. So random and strange.
That's what
and
I'm saying.
All they
though.
Want is like a family, and he wants to provide. Like after all that crap.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like
just
that's
insane.
That's why I liked it is because it was kind of like a weird end point to like a happily ever after thing. It was like, okay, yeah, all this other like crazy societal shit is going on in the background, but they are still arriving at the like we're finding our, you know, our happily ever after somehow.
That would have to go with Ruben's point about them secretly being really boring and just wanting boring things like a family and like someone has to earn money and someone has to, you know, be a wife and stop hooking, whatever, you know, like so like they're secretly really boring and they're just outwardly really crazy.
That was the thing though, is that I liked that it equated that sort of like homely or like hominess to these people who would seem to be on the fringes. Like, it's like, okay.
Hominess.
That's
homely
yeah,
would mean ugly.
I changed what I said halfway through. I said homie.
But
yeah, I know. Homie. This normality to these people who would seem to be on the fringes. It's like, okay, they're not, you know, just like space aliens. Although, you know, what you said earlier, that they're Kryptonians. But no, like, these people aren't space aliens. Like, they have the same sort of desires that normal people have. Well, and they... Yes, Ruben, stop shaking your head. Yes.
I can't.
That was the implication, though, is that it's like they're looking for the same things that other people are looking for. They just have to go about it in a different way.
No, I don't get that at all from the movie.
I feel like I
don't know what movie you were watching.
I mean, I feel like I don't think, I don't know. I think that the movie doesn't see that as a positive thing at all. Like, that they want those things is just like, I mean, obviously it ends up being irrelevant to what ends up happening, but also that it's all fake, like the using the Mr. Innocent and the other person and their like extremely weird morality of like he has to be equally debased as she has been in order for them to like regain their normal life, like that the same thing holds true, that like achieving some fake normal life through like prostitution and being in a gang none of it's ever gonna end happily, and obviously that's how it works out in the movie, but I don't think that the director was trying to say like here's these like marginalized people, but they're not that different from you and I. Like, I feel like the point that he was making was something weirder and sadder, that just like it's all It's all a waste. There's no point in trying for anything.
There's this point where she says after
what a shitty country.
Yuki's boyfriend dies, and she's like, and she's going to the hospital to get the abortion, right? And she's talking to Akira, and she's like, man, people sure do cry a lot sometimes. I cried for 3 days straight, but luckily that's all over, you know, like basically.
Yeah, and she's like, I guess I have to get this abortion now. Yeah, but, I kind of wanted to keep the baby, right. But oh well.
So it goes, you know.
I like that about the movie, though, is that there was like, they were really flippant about things that were, they would normally be like serious dramatic sticking points in this movie. They're like the point where she tells his friend that she's pregnant. He's like, she's like, but I don't think it's your baby. And he's like, oh really? And he's like, well, I can just pretend it's my baby. And she's like, okay, we're happy. I mean,
that's, you know, like, sort of what's going on in this movie is that people keep wanting to, like, you know, sort of like erase the past, or like, you know, just clear, you know, just knock down the past and put a new building up and just completely ignore context or everything that's happened. You know, that's kind of what the woman wants to do, and the rape victim, and then that's kind of what Akira's friend, Yuki's potential boyfriend.
Well, at first she wants someone to acknowledge, she wants to talk about it, but then when she realizes nobody will ever talk to her about it, no one. She's like, okay, can we please just forget about this then and pretend like this never happened? Can we please just go back to when it didn't happen? But at first, she does want people to talk to her. Like, she actually, like, this is when the movie, like, hits to me, like, the low point in where I think its heart is at, is when she comes to the rapist to confront him about the rape and is like, hey, can we please just, like, talk about it? And he doesn't even talk to her about it. Like, that, to me, was when I just, like, I could not feel more low at this moment, just watching it. You know, it's like when, come on, like, that just, like, just remembering this makes me really, really angry. And, so.
I kind of like your point, though. I think it makes me like the movie slightly more, though. Like, the idea of, like, it's a subject that people just refuse to talk about, I guess, and that, like, their refusal to talk about it means that there'll never be any sense of, like, justice or normalcy, I guess.
Yeah.
I agree. I think that that's I mean, that gets at why, part of why I like the movie, that just the, I mean, it's something that's talked about in other New Wave movies too, especially A Town of Love and Hope, which is a terrible title in terms of what the movie is actually about, but
maybe it's a great title because it's a mislead.
Yeah, but like, it's so obviously ironic and silly. Like, it's not even Oshima's title, he just wanted to call it The Boy Who Sold His Pigeon, but the studio didn't like that, I guess. but there is a sense of just like erasure and trying to pretend that all the horrible things that have happened in Japan haven't happened. Crazed Fruit gets added a little bit also, where like the kids talk about how they shouldn't even bother going to school anymore because all the professors are just teaching like it's 30 years ago and World War II didn't happen. And it makes school a useless premise because they're ignoring the contemporary life. So, in terms of this movie, continuing this theme of silly erasure, I'm okay with it.
I prefer Larry Clark's kids.
I've not
seen
that
30 years later. Sorry.
I also haven't seen all of Rebel Without a Cause. So
yeah, I really have no other good comparison to something like this. Like, it's weird. Like, I should watch more movies about young people, I guess.
I guess.
Or not.
If you want. They're kind of boring, like, in general. Not just in this movie, but like,
yeah, I don't know, I guess, yeah, right,
kids are the worst.
I don't want to have to interact with myself at 18. Mm. I'll tell you that. I feel sorry for everybody who had to.
Yeah, me too. I'm extra nice to my family now because I'm like, oh yeah, you had to deal with me. Right. Thanks for that.
Right. Okay, let's get this hate fest over with.
We've talked about like sociological things, I guess, in this film, but like to me, the film itself, in a way, it doesn't. I feel like I have to know that it was made in 1960 in post-war Japan. Like, I don't feel like it's internal to the film, in a way, and I think that's part of what I don't like about it, is that I don't have a sense of like the society that the film takes place in, if that makes any sense.
I actually get that completely, and it's been a really hard sticking point for most of the like so-called new wave movies that I've been watching, is that they assume quite a bit of knowledge about like the culture and contemporary society that's going on. Like, four different movies that I've watched all deal with the same like protesting in different ways. Cruel Story of Youth is one of them, and like it's important to varying degrees, but they never explicitly say what it is. Like, I had to look up what these people were even protesting and like what it meant at all, and that like there's definitely a feeling of assuming that the audience is already very aware of these circumstances, well, which kind of points to an interesting like inwardness of the movies, like that makes them harder to grasp, yeah, for
right
external audiences.
Right. I mean, that probably that was their whole point, was also they were made for those audiences, and not thinking about, yeah, whether or not other people are gonna get it, you know? Like, I think like that as a criticism, I guess I can understand. Like, I also feel like movies should be able to get them, even though like maybe you don't have the political context. But at the same time, I think like, it's fair game to also not always make everything for everyone, right? Like, it's like, okay, like they're making it.
Oh, I don't know. I agree with that. I just like, I don't. It's not. Yeah. I don't know. I don't feel like I don't know where it takes place, if that makes any sense. Like, and I feel like that's a fairly well established in narrative films. Like, something that you set up in a way. Like, you know, I know that jazz is happening at the time that the movie takes place, but that's kind of about it. Like, I don't know. Like, the society. I don't feel the same way, for instance, about German New Wave, which deals with a lot of these same issues of like absence and sort of ignoring things, you know, a little more from the other side, ignoring things that they did as opposed, yeah, to things that were done to them. And like, you know, when I watch, I don't know, Wings of Desire or something, or Aguirre, the Wrath of God, like I don't know, I have a sense of the world in which it takes, yeah, place.
Well, that honestly, like, I can understand what you're talking about there, Ruben.
Can or can't?
Can.
Okay.
I can understand that. I honestly, like, I just didn't care about that. It did not bother me. It didn't bother me, yeah, about the film at all. Like, I was taken by the film, like, from the word go, and I was just like, this has so much energy and life and vitality, and I really like the way it looks and the way all the characters act for some reason, and even though they're, like, horrible people, I still, like, find them captivating to watch, and I find all of the things that happen in the film captivating to watch. Like, I felt like all the like misdirects that were in the movie like really worked for me. They really landed. I was like, okay, this is going in a direction that I didn't see it going in at all, and I really like, you know, the way that it kind of lulled me into thinking that it was going to be kind of a conventional story, and it was like, oh no, it's, you know, we're taking a hard left turn here, and you know, he's, oh, this character's not going to die here, we're gonna keep going with this, and there's going to be more stuff that happens, and it's going to get a little bit crazier. And I was like, I'm with it. I was with it all the way through. And so, you know, I acknowledge that there are some sociological issues and maybe some, I guess, I don't know how to say it, like, maybe there's kind of a setting vacuum on the movie that you can't really tell, like, you know, the world it was supposed to be set in, but it honestly didn't bother me at all. I liked, you know, what it showed me, and I liked the performances of everybody involved, and I liked the way that they crafted the film. And
I did really like the look of the film. I don't know if I couldn't tell from what Ilya said, but it sounded like he did not.
I just thought,
like, the look of the film.
Yeah, I just
based
thought,
on,
like,
comparison it.
Yeah, Thomas Anderson. Like, at first, I really, like, I was enjoying it. But then when I started really disliking what was going on, I also started disliking the way it was going on. So, like, it's like it kind of went hand in hand with me. So, and actually, to not always just harp on about what I didn't like about the movie, because that was also kind of boring. I mean, I really, like, to me, like, the main actor was really pretty great. I thought he was a pretty engaging kind of guy. I thought it was, like, again, too bad he was the guy that he was in this movie, but I thought that the actor was pretty cool. But then actually when that moment came where he walks into that artist room or whatever, and one of them starts, like, phrenologizing or whatever about his face and how, like, oh yeah, his eyes represent this part, or like his mouth represents this part of society or whatever, and he just hits him in the face and or, like, lights a cigarette in his face and walks out. Like, I actually felt like maybe in a way some of the things that I was kind of like, when I think about actors and what I like about actors, sometimes they are really, like, kind of, I don't know, maybe they're kind of stupid. You know, that like, that made me think about that. It's like, maybe it's not like when I think, oh yeah, her energy. I really liked her energy. Like, what the fuck does that even mean? Like, what do I mean by energy? What do I mean by I liked her face? It's weird. And even though maybe that scene where those people talk about his face is kind of like the same thing that happens when he goes to this to the art gallery and starts hanging paintings upside down. It's like, haha, stupid intellectuals intellectualizing everything. How stupid of them. Maybe that was all that scene was, but it actually made me reconsider a little bit of what I like when I think about liking actors. So I guess there's that, you know. That was...
Yeah, I like that scene that you're talking about where he goes into the... We keep just calling her the woman. I can't remember the character's name. The woman that Akira rapes. But she's an artist and she has a studio.
Remembering
in her
house. Through her victimhood.
Yeah, basically.
A super famous artist too, by the fact that
she's well known. Yeah, she has a bunch of people in her home studio just, like, hanging out, listening to music, talking about art, I guess. And one of the guys is like, you know, Akira walks in. I think he's just comes in unannounced, doesn't he? Just, like, shows up there, and she acts like he's, yeah, she just acts like he's some model that she used for one of her paintings or something. And that one guy comes up to him.
He follows her home. She tries to run away. She, like, jumps in a taxi, and he steals a motorcycle and follows her.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay, that's where he steals the motorcycle, yeah. But that guy just, like, starts talking about all these, you know, like, really intellectual things about the way he looks and about how he sort of represents society, and he just, like, blows smoke in that guy's face. And I liked that scene because it was it made the film feel like it was aware of, you know, the sort of, like, intellectualizing of that context of that character, like, you know, painting him as some sort of, like, just stereotypical, like, youth in revolt, like, this is the way the young kids act these days or whatever. It's like, I liked that the movie had that kind of awareness about, you know, the way it was being perceived itself. Like, it was almost like a meta-textual thing where it was like, this is the way people are going to see this movie when it comes out in theaters.
This predates Graveyard of Honor, but they have a similar moment in Graveyard of Honor that happens at the beginning of the film, and I kind of like it better, where it's like a narrator, and he's like giving explanations for why the main character in Graveyard of Honor is so crazy, and then he's like, wait, no, there's no explanation. He's just crazy. He's a crazy person. He's like, you know, after the war, and he's like, no, he was a wild dog before the war.
So it's like the anti-psychologist scene in Psycho? Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, they mention in that scene fauvism, which is the Henri Matisse and Wild Beasts is translation. So there's a more joking about modern art. Pretty fun.
Never not funny.
But
I want to see jokes about, like, Mona Lisa, like something that everyone regards as, like, good. I feel like joking about modern art is such, like, an easy punchline.
It's true. Also because most modern art I like better than the Mona Lisa, so.
Yeah, I agree with that, yeah. The Mona Lisa's not that impressive. I've seen it.
Well, something else then.
No, but I mean, I agree.
Or something?
But,
I mean, also,
I think there have been jokes about, like, how modernism
Starry
is,
Night.
Like, you know, like, supposed to be supposedly destroying the old to make way for the new, and, like, creating a new perception of art, and, like, drawing a mustache on the Mona Lisa is, like, a thing that people talk about. And I remember in an art history class saying that I wish someone would actually do that. Because it would be funny, and I don't care about that painting as, like, a thing, but I don't know. Maybe I would regret that in, like, 200 years when there's no more regular Mona Lisa, just the one with the mustache. Who knows?
If you live that well.
With the thing that I was talking about before, I almost said this. I don't know why I ended up not saying it, but I'm going to say it now when I was talking about sort of the situationlessness of this movie. And that, so I saw the movie Kids, which is what I compare this to, when I was, like, pretty young. And I was like, this movie is stupid. It's just awful people acting awfully. And I hated it. And, you know, I had no intention of revisiting it, and then one night in, like, a chat room, someone was like, I'm putting on Kids, and, like, we started watching it, and I was like, I hate this movie. And then, like, there was a certain point in the movie where there's, like, a young woman, she's riding a taxi cab, and it's just, like, a shot of her looking out of the taxi, and it's just sort of, like, storefront after storefront after storefront after storefront, and she's, like, about to cry, and, like, something about, like, the tension between, like, her emotions about her personal situation and, like, the meaninglessness of, like, all these other people, I guess, in a way, like, it gave me a real feeling of, like, that the director and writer understood, like, how people became that way, I guess, or, like, a more fundamental understanding of complex things like class and economics and race and stuff like that. It was all contained in this one shot. It wasn't like there was, like, a long monologue about, like, the situation in New York in the early 90s about poverty or anything like that. And so when, like, I say that this movie didn't achieve that for me, it's kind of like, it's not that I really wanted to know, like, a lot about Japanese history or something, but that sort of, like, everything that happens in this movie kind of feels like it happens on, like, a set. Like, you know, they do something here, and they do something there, and they do something somewhere else, and it doesn't feel like connected to like some sort of larger stuff going on. Like, I don't know.
I think I pretty much agree with that. I feel like most of the causality in the movie is pretty apparent, like A to B, this happened and now we're like this, and it's pretty straightforward. For me, mostly, it didn't bother me because I thought it was just, like, I was like, okay, so this is pretty simple in what you're trying to say, and now the movie just looks fun and moves very fast for the rest of it. And that was all I cared about. I was like, I'm not bored because everything is moving quickly and looks cool in a way that I enjoy.
Right.
And I did actually think that the main character was pretty charismatic, also, the actor. Mm-hmm. And that one.
I am alone.
You didn't like that the actor okay. either?
And also, well, I did like
no.
it.
No, that's what I mean. I meant.
No, but I'm the only one who didn't like him.
Yeah.
This is me.
I liked him. I liked Yuki also.
Yeah, I liked Yuki. I liked, Yuki was the only one who I liked.
Was
the
I liked the
I think
the
I've
woman
seen her in
too,
other stuff.
The...
Like, yeah, I liked one character. Yeah, she said even something that. Terrible about black people, but at least she wasn't as terrible as everyone else.
At least she didn't.
I liked her as an actress.
Right.
I didn't
right.
like her as a
right,
person.
Right.
Well,
that...
I'm not going to hang out with
Yuki. Make that distinction.
Nobody's really that good as a person in this movie. Well, except for the black guy that... I was going to say, yeah, the black guy that runs
yeah,
the jazz bar
really
is
nice.
Pretty cool. He's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's
he also didn't seem like he spoke...
Exactly.
I was going to say, it also didn't seem like he spoke any Japanese.
Because
he doesn't really speak Japanese. That's
yeah,
he just
he
talks in English. He's like,
Japanese,
come on,
I
come
think.
On, let's go. Come on.
Are you talking about the character or the actor?
Okay.
Because it's
either...
pretty clear that the actor is actually speaking not English, and that they dubbed him over.
Oh, I thought they just dubbed him. I didn't know he was speaking.
Yeah, I didn't
English.
Notice. I mean, most of the sound in the movie is dubbed because Japanese studios were too cheap to record on location sound for almost all movies in this time period. But. What was I gonna say? Yeah, I don't know. I thought that in some ways I almost thought that his character was like a joke on the idea of like American savior thing where they like swim off into the sunset almost and then
literally.
I like that interpretation.
I like that interpretation too.
Considering that every other American in the movie basically just wants to have sex with Yuki for money. And he's the only other
true,
American
yeah.
in the whole movie, and he's really nice, and he's black, and he's so basically, I mean, whatever, also magical in some way. Like, I mean, like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
it's
I
just
agree.
A weird, weird scene. It's a really weird scene, especially considering that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, I was just gonna say that I guess I interpreted his magicalness as to be like intentional and not completely like going into the stereotype, but in a self-aware way. But I could be wrong. But I don't know.
No, I mean it kind of makes sense based off of what Akira says, what Patrick mentioned, where he's like, black people invented jazz, and then
right.
white people stole it, and then we took it from
yeah.
them, and we're the worst. Is kind of like, you know. You know that you're looking from his weirdo perspective that doesn't
yeah.
actually really make sense.
Right. Way to go.
Well, to him, maybe in a weird way, that's like his dream, right? Because he keeps appropriating black culture and like mannerisms or whatever and music. And it's like, so obviously he would like to swim into the sunset with a black person, probably. Like maybe in his mind, like that's, that's as
who
good
wouldn't?
As it gets.
This is the good life.
Every night I go to sleep and imagine me and Ice Cube swimming off into the sunset.
Yeah, it's usually Bun B for me, right?
I would prefer Bun B. Or Pimp C if he was still alive.
Yeah.
Finally, we get to say RIP Pimp C in one of our podcasts. We've waited so long. I say RIP Pimp C every day, and somehow I've never said it in a podcast.
It's always hard to incorporate.
RIP Pimp C. Yeah. Everyone pour out a 40.
I'll definitely pour out that 40, especially since I can no longer drink them.
Is this like our longest podcast ever?
No.
Maybe Margaret including was, you.
Yeah.
I wasn't
you
here for
Margaret.
Sweet, sweet Margaret. That was a good one. Yeah.
And we have mostly stayed on topic this time.
That's true.
Like, we've had some longer podcasts where, like, we talk about John Carpenter playing video games for 15 minutes or Cougar Town.
Yeah. I think
there wasn't much digression.
I think
here.
We strayed for like 10 minutes or 15 minutes this time too about something that is too long ago for me to remember. Like, I don't even remember, but I remember at one point wanting to say, like, let's get back to talking about the movie, and then I guess we did. So it's all good.
This might be.
My feeling is always no.
Yeah.
I'm on no also.
It's all right.
Freeformer is a better.
I always get excited whenever we talk about like Cougar Town or whatever.
I was going to say, this is definitely probably our longest podcast in terms of per minute of movie. Like, if someone were to listen to this whole podcast, they could also watch the movie in the same amount of time.
Exactly. That's true.
So listen to us instead of watching this movie. No, actually, go
do
watch
both
this
things
movie.
At the same time. You could just like mute the movie.
Just have us play.
Audio commentary.
We're like we're like riff tracks,
just
but
spoiling
we're
spoiling everything ahead of time. Obviously, because we start talking about the ending of the movie, it's like from.
They're gonna have us on the next Criterion release of this movie.
Sure.
We're gonna be a commentary track.
That's the goal, is for us to be the Criterion commentators on some movie. Here are four dudes. They have literally nothing to do with filmmaking or these movies in particular.
But we couldn't get Donald Ritchie, so we just got those four dudes instead.
One of them did write a paper.
If you
about
add
the
them
Japanese
together,
writer.
They're the same age as Donald Ritchie.
And still with considerably less expertise on this topic, despite combining four different persons' knowledges. Sad.
I think
Patrick,
I'm done.
Yeah, I'm good.
I'm satisfied.
Basil.
Stealing the milk is a reference to the 400 blows.
Oh,
I wrote that in my notes.
And so hey-o.
Out. Oh, nice. Yeah, let's end it with that.
All right, guys. Thank you for listening to Loose Cannons, especially the last 10 minutes where we stopped talking about the movie.
And talk about how we did such a good job talking about the movie
and talked about talking about the movie. So thank you for listening to that part.
Since
Ilya is no longer a listener, this only goes out to Michael Dwylo, our one remaining listener. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, thank you.
All right. Goodbye.
All right.
Bye.
See ya. The